You are listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb, and Richard Moore.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we're joined by Daniele Friberencini.
Hello.
Ciao. Come stai?
New listeners will think that is actually Daniel's name. It's Daniel Freeb.
It is Daniel's name now.
Oh, okay.
Daniel Freeb, also known as Daniel Freeb. Freeb.
What else?
Freeba.
Yeah. Anyway.
The season's off. Chaps, we're up and running. There's been some racing.
Charity Shield's over, Napalm. The pre-season friendly.
Well...
Have you redeemed yourself? Because, you know, we had a whole succession. We had, I think, two or three consecutive years where you poo-pooed the Tour Down Under and you were upbraided about it, rightfully so.
Mm. I've been bullied into changing my opinion.
Watching the Tour Down Under, I've been struck by how much drinking Lotto Soudal will have been doing.
Already this season. Toasting their win.
A lot of boozing. The most heavily drinking, heavily alcohol dependent team of the year so far, because they're allowed alcohol only when they have a win. And they've had a few.
They have.
What a motivator that was,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Absolutely. Four wins so far for Lotto Soudal, if you count the Schwalbe Classic, the sort of curtain raiser, the pre-season friendly for the pre-season friendly.
You'd be able to cycle in a straight line after all that.
Well, shall we sort of run through a bit of the news? We'll talk in more detail about the Tour Down Under in part one of the podcast, I think. But I think we can all agree that the big stories from Adelaide are that Richie Port's streak on Willunga Hill has come to an end after 6 years. He did, however, have the Strava KOM.
He went up it pretty quick.
He did go up it quite quickly, and he sealed the overall victory. The other huge story is Rowan Dennis's Chris Froome impersonation. I'm not sure if you saw that on social media. It was uncanny.
Wasn't it fantastic?
He's clearly an expert at studying body language. Prior to the men's Tour Down Under, of course, there was the women's race where there were stage wins for Chloe Hosking and Amanda Spratt. And Ruth Winder, the Keithley-born American, won stage three, which set up overall victory for the Trek Segafredo rider. They're also often running in, or often cycling, really, Richard, we should say. They're often cycling in Argentina at the Vuelta a San Juan. Two stages so far. Victories for Rudy Barbier of Israel Startup Nation and then Fernando Gaviria of UAE Team Emirates. Couple of big crashes there already. On day one, apparently caused by a spectator, and on day two, caused by a dog. So the riders having to run the gauntlet somewhat there. Daniel, this might be something that's caught your ears. The Italian team run by Luca Shinto, Vini Zabu MTK, are banning power meters in races.
Yeah, it doesn't shock me, this one. Luca Shinto, he is a pretty sort of dyed-in-the-wool former Italian pro. As always, sort of made this point about power meters. He's very much against them. I remember, so Luca Shinto rode for Mappe until around about 2000, and then he qualified as a director sportif. And I did a magazine feature on the weekend, the sort of director sportif's course he did with the Italian Federation. So I spent quite a bit of time with him there. And his methods were pretty sort of... pretty unconventional even then, and particularly, you know, his approach to sort of modern technology was pretty interesting. I remember him telling me about one rider in his team who was on the phone to his dad too much on his mobile phone, because he was already a DS of an amateur team back then. And Shinto had snatched the mobile phone out of this poor lad's hand and thrown it in a wheat field, the kind of wheat was sort of shoulder high, and this poor kid had never found his mobile phone again. And then I remember him also telling me about, you know, in his day, how it worked with sort of coaches and prescribed training sessions. And he said that Aldo Sassi, the late coach of Mappe, used to phone him up and ask him what he'd been doing in training, and you know, that was how they used to log the training back then. And Shinto would just keep a printed sheet next to the telephone of what he should be doing. And he'd literally, you know, every time the phone rang and it was Sassy on the other end, he'd just pick up the sheet and he'd just recite what Sassi wanted to hear, when actually just been out with Max Chiandri, you know, having gelato.
Very, very good friends, aren't they, Luca Shinto and Max Chiandri?
Yeah, there was a sort of classic, a real clique of Tuscan pros, the Michele Bartoli and Paolo Fornaciari, who now has an ice cream parlor, funnily enough, a gelateria, and Rolf Sorensen as well, used to live in that neck of the woods in Tuscany, sort of between Florence and Pistoia and Shinto, and they used to train together every day. That was when sort of Tuscany ruled the world as far as professional cycling was concerned.
So what's behind this ban on power meters in races? The riders will still be able to use them in training.
Yeah,
well, they'll find them in wheat fields.
Shinto's, I mean, his point, it's a point that's been made by other direct sportifs and riders in the past, is that his riders were paying too much attention to them in races, and it was sort of conditioning the way they were trying to, or they were riding races. And also, I think there is a valid point about learning to sort of trust your body and to sort of capture the feedback you're getting from your body. I mean, some people would also argue that devices like power meters help you to sort of become more sensitive to your body. You know, it's a kind of biofeedback. If you know you try and go a bit slower and then you see what effect that has on the watts or heart rate or so on, then that can actually sort of strengthen your sort of knowledge and understanding of your own body and how it reacts.
I think the thing Shinto said, wasn't it, that he was fed up of hearing riders say, oh, I was putting out 400 watts and I still couldn't do anything, and you know, the artificial ceiling of seeing the number on a screen perhaps inhibiting the performance before the legs and the lungs were ready to give in.
I don't know if you guys remember, but I distinctly remember there being grumbles from team managers and direct sportives in the 90s about heart rate monitors, and they made exactly the same point. And there has been this sort of undercurrent of discontent or frustration with power meters over the past few years. It tends to not come from riders themselves. It tends to be from race directors and directeurs sportifs. But yeah, I do remember that being the case back in the 90s.
Well, Vinny Szabo MTK will be at the Giro d'Italia. They've got one of the wild cards and they'll be putting out unknown watts during the race. They're currently racing in Argentina, of course.
I feel a kilometre zero coming on.
Yeah, watts not occurring. anyway, David Lepartion, the president of the UCI, is very keen to get in on the gravel boom. There's been talk of a UCI-sanctioned series of gravel off-road events, and now talk of a gravel world championships, which has kind of, it's ruffled the gravel in the off-road world, because people are saying, well, there's already prestigious events such as Dirty Kanza, that kind of an unofficial world championships. This is clearly going to happen. The UCI are going to get their fingers
claws
into this particular pie, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a bit like the debate around mountain biking. When it came along, it was a sort of renegade sport, and downhilling especially, because it's not an Olympic discipline. But there is a UCI World Championship, and it's actually a great event. I've been to it a few times, been to World Cups and World Championships in Fort William in Scotland. They seem to have embraced that, maybe reluctantly at first, but they've come on board. BMX, another example. And I can see the attraction of remaining sort of outside the mainstream. But if that sort of endorsement can make the sport bigger, more attractive, more understandable for people as well, that's surely a good thing. I you know, we know that a lot of former road pros are switching to gravel this year, including the cycling podcast Ian Boswell. But I think in America, especially where the road scene is struggling and big events are dying, there's a real opportunity to grow some great, very unusual and original events over there. Some exist already, but that calendar could become quite attractive. And a UCI endorsement surely can't do any harm.
Yeah, I think this is destined to gather momentum. I mean, if you look at what's happened, for example, in running, and you know, more on an amateur level there, because you've always had a lot of people who run but don't necessarily watch professional athletics or professional running. But that said, the big story of the last few years in sort of recreational running has been the growth of these ultra events, you know, sort of 50 kilometers plus running events, rather than, and their growth is sort of eclipsing the growth or eclipsing the sort of the current prosperity of the marathon scene. There are more and more of these events, and I think it speaks to you know, probably things that are happening in society at large, people's kind of individualistic streak, wanting to do something very different, and you know, marathons are not sort of, or marathons are seen as a kind of box ticking exercise that a lot of people have done now. And yeah, I think similarly in cycling, people, you know, want to retain that sort of spirit of adventure. There are also other things that play in its favor. Obviously the safety is one huge factor. And you know, you talk about the United States, Rich. We've often maligned the fact that American races don't look that great on TV. I mean, as I understand it, there's a huge number of fantastic gravel routes in the States that, you know, would make great venues for gravel races.
And also from a logistics point of view, in terms of organising, fewer road closures, easier to have a kind of a big party village, sort of like the 90s mountain bike boom kind of reborn, I guess.
Gravel Grand Tour.
A gravel grand tour, yeah, it's sure to happen, or maybe it will happen. But well, Explore, our series will be
covering
there,
that, all covering over that. That,
yeah, if that happens.
One thing I think we don't really understand with gravel yet, and especially those of us who haven't done a lot of gravel riding, is whether there is a sort of certain set of abilities that will sort of transfer across, you know, types of gravel race, and whether the sort of same riders will come to the fore in all of them. I mean, I can sort of imagine in sort of my ignorance and naivety that you know, you would get quite different riders excelling on different surfaces and obviously on different courses. I mean, you see races like Trobro Leon, for example, is very, very different from Strade Bianche, which is very different from Paris-Roubaix, for example.
Yeah, well, this is actually something that I talked to Ian Boswell about for the first episode of our new revamped, relaunched Explore series, which will be out imminently. No release date on that just yet, but it will be in the next couple of weeks. And he was talking about how he's going to be doing quite a lot of these events this year and is not taking for granted that just because he's raced on the road at the very top level and can complete grand tours and stage races, that will necessarily put him in the very elite when it comes to racing off-road. So listen out for that. Sticking with off-road, the Cyclocross World Cup reached its conclusion in Hoogeheide with victories for Mathieu van der Poel and Lucinda Brand. The overall World Cup winners this season, Toon Aerts and Annemarie Voorst, and they will all be at the World Championships in Dubendorf in Switzerland this weekend. A couple of cancellations for different reasons. The Tour of Oman has been cancelled. ASO-run event, of course, part of the Middle Eastern swing, and that's been cancelled because of the death of the country's ruler, Sultan Qaboos bin Said. There's a 40-day period of mourning in Oman, so the race is off. And in China, the Tour of Hainan has been cancelled because of the coronavirus, which is spreading in China. Finally, if you want to go on a cycling holiday in Mallorca with Lance Armstrong and George Hincapie, it will set you back $30,000, and there are only 12 places.
Nine.
Oh, goodness me. No, I'll go on my own cycling holiday.
Yeah, thanks to friends of the podcast.
Oh, goodness.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And if you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25 at the checkout. One or two of you had problems with the code last week, but it has been sorted now. There was a little hiccup, but it has been sorted. It's fully functioning. So for 25% off, SISCP25. Tour Down Under. Are we returning Down Under?
Indeed. Well, the World Tour season is underway, and although Richie Porte's streak on Willunga Hill which extended to 6 years, was broken by the British rider Matt Holmes of Lotto Soudal. Port did win the race overall. As you said, Richard, lots of cause for Lotto Soudal to celebrate over the course of the week. They have basically banned alcohol for all riders and staff during races and training camps, apart from on the occasion of a rider's birthday or a race win. And, well, Caleb Ewan won two sprint finishes and Matt Holmes won the final stage on Willunga Hill. The other stages were won by Port, Giacomo Nizzolo of NTT.
Worth a mention, I would have thought.
I completely wrote off Bjarne Riis.
Well, there's a team, formerly Dimension Data, who didn't have many wins, certainly not in January. And I don't know if it's Bjarne Riis Midas touch. He's down there. He was down there in Australia with the team. But that will be a huge relief to them. I thought, you know, them and Israel Startup Nation in San Juan as well, probably quite important wins for those two teams.
Yep. And, well, another important win and kicking it all off in the Tour Down Under was Sam Bennett getting his first victory for De Koninck Quickstep. So Richie Port won overall ahead of Diego Ulissi, Simon Geschke, Rowan Dennis and Dylan Van Baarle, who round out the top five. And, yeah, well, we're off and rolling.
Off and rolling. Matt Holmes' win was pretty extraordinary. He was in the breakaway that Richie Port bridged up to. He went very quickly up Willunga Hill. He's obviously in great form. And he was second on the stage, Matt Holmes' surprise winner. Guy's raced domestically in the UK, and his agent, Gary McQuaid, made a comment, didn't he, about how difficult it had been to try and interest even Pro Conti teams in him.
Yeah, a couple of years searching for a team for Matt Holmes. He spent the last 5 years with Madison Genesis, before that with Team Rally, 26 years old. So, you know, he's not a traditional neo-pro coming in at sort of 22, 23.
Just 26.
Just really, 26, so, yeah. Sure, but you
yeah.
know,
no, it's still, it's old to make your debut in the World Tour, isn't it?
It is. And, well, Lotto Soudal have kind of, they seem to be taking a couple of British riders at a time at the moment. They've also signed John Dibben this season, given Dibben a sort of second bite of the cherry. Second dibs, well done. Prior to that, of course, they had James Shaw, who did a couple of years, and then they let him go. But yeah, an interesting one. Well, hoping to speak to Gary McQuaid about Matt Holmes at some point.
I was sort of thinking about this theme of kind of late bloomers, but also, you know, we've mentioned in the last few weeks the number of British riders there are in the in World Tour teams this year. And, you know, cycling does go through cycles when certain nationalities become almost fashionable. And, you know, there are practical reasons for that as well. Like, in the last few years, well, I think the number of agents has multiplied across the sport, certainly. And, there are quite a number of British agents now who... Or agents representing the interests of British riders who, you know, will speak to team managers about guys like Holmes, who have been, you know, riding well for a few years, but wouldn't ordinarily have flown under the radar. I mean, if you contrast that with sort of 15 or 20 years ago, there were probably only, about five or six sort of big agents who were regularly placing riders in teams. And, you know, in their client portfolio, the sort of the established names would always get sort of take precedence. And so I think that's one change. And, you know, obviously we've talked in the last few years as well a lot about the anglicisation of professional cycling, and you know, there are no sort of doubts about British riders settling in most teams. But yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. But he is a guy who, you know, just to look at his results, he's not won a lot of races. You would imagine that it would have taken quite a sort of an eagle-eyed talent scout to identify him as someone who would succeed straight away in the World Tour.
What about Richie Port then? Is this the annual Richie Port's going to finish on the podium at the Tour de France conversation?
Quite sobering to realise that in 2 days' time he will be 35, Richie Port, because we still, I think of him as a up-and-coming Richie Port in a way.
Well,
unfulfilled potential, you could argue, on the, you know, in the biggest races, but there was a piece in Velo News today, actually, about the Tour Down Under by Andy Hood, asking whether the the very sort of tried and tested format to the race. You know, stages tend to go to the same places, tend to be on the same courses, and that's been the case for 20 odd years now. Whether it should have a shake up with a new director next year, Stuart O'Grady is taking over, and a dissenting voice in that debate was Richie Porte, who said it should remain exactly as it is, which is not much of a surprise, really, because it certainly suits him. You know, I'm sure that he doesn't set out to make the Tour Down Under his kind of calling card each year. For him, it will be a stepping stone to bigger targets. It's not the Tour Down Under's fault or his form there that I don't think that's the reason why he hasn't really delivered in the Grand Tours recently. But he is getting older now. He will tail off at some point. He is in great form now in January, but I don't think that has any bearing necessarily on what will come later in the summer.
No, I mean, looking at Trek Segafredo, as you say, Port's 35 in a couple of days' time. Vincenzo Nibali is already 35. Their big signing, and Bauke Mollema, the young man of the three, is 33. I mean, it's all a bit last of the summer wine in the Grand Tour stakes at Trek Segafredo, isn't it? But I think Richie Porte, we've said this many times, that he has been a victim of partly nationality in being Australian. He's been the big hope for Australia when it comes to the Tour de France, and perhaps that has been an unrealistic expectation. He's been a world-class week-long stage racer. He's won Paris-Nice a couple of times. He's won what else has he won? He's won the Tour of Romandie, Tour de Suisse, so Volta a Catalunya as well over the course of his career. I mean, that's an impressive record. It's just that the expectation is that the riders of his type should automatically be able to make that next step up to a sort of Tour de France podium. And I think it's just too big a leap for him.
I think Richie Porte has also been penalised by the sort of moving Grand Tours, or the move by race organisers to sort of scatter what we would call GC days more liberally through the course. If you go back to the sort of 90s, there'd be sort of seven or eight days when the GC would be decided, and then the rest of the time, well, the stages were dedicated to sprinters. There'd be sort of a block of three mountain stages, then a break, then three more mountain stages plus two time trials. And I think Richie Porte probably would have thrived in that environment. I think he has a bit of an issue in the same way that maybe Thibaut Pinot does, with just producing his best on more than a handful of days, because on those days when he does produce his best, he's up there with the best riders in the world, probably in the top three or four climbers in the world in the mountains, and he's won even long-ish flat time trials. But I wonder what kind of circumstances, he could still win a Grand Tour. I kind of think that, if he went into a Grand Tour with all guns blazing, and it was a very sort of front-loaded Grand Tour with a lot of big stages early on, and he got the jersey and he was in a good position, and he's a rider who I think thrives on confidence and momentum. And if a team really rallied around him then, and he was in a great position after 10 days, I could see him possibly pulling it off in those circumstances. I mean, it's a long shot at this point, but he's also, he's the victim really of, I suppose, unfair expectations, or expectations that have come from outside and not, I don't think, necessarily from him.
Well, the big stories from the Tour Down Under then, Caleb Ewan winning, Richie Porte winning overall, Rowan Dennis's Chris Froome impersonation. If you hadn't checked that out on social media, you'll be able to find that uncanny. But also Mitch Docker and Lachlan Morton of EF Education First shaving their heads and moustaches to raise money for people affected by the wildfires. And I think, we saw moving images on TV and still photography of the peloton going through areas that have been burnt out. I spoke to Mitch this morning because we are launching the first episode of his Life in the Peloton series on our feed imminently. Should be online as you listen to this now. A first interview with Jimmy Whelan, and Mitch said it was obvious that the smoke was in the air. It was hanging pretty thick on occasions, but the area around Adelaide not being as affected not been affected as badly as over in Melbourne, where the Sun Tour is due to take place in a couple of weeks' time. But yeah, Mitch and Lachlan Morton, completely, well, Mitch is unrecognisable without the mullet and the moustache. I mean, it's quite unsettling.
He looks like a different person.
He does. But yeah, tune in to our new series. Mitch's Life in the Peloton kicks off with an interview with Jimmy Whelan.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by LACA, bicycle insurance powered by you, a community of cyclists all sharing the cost of the premiums and ensuring that in the event that you need to claim on your insurance, you get your claim settled quickly and fairly. And well, don't just take our word from it. Let's hear from a rider, a founder member of the 6am cycling club, so called because they get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go riding. They have around 30 members, most if not all of whom are LACA customers.
Hi, my name's Leslie. I've been a LACA customer since summer of last year. The cyclists that are in the club that I set up with a friend about 4 years ago are all with LACA. So went out for a bike ride with my mate Tom. We'd signed up to an ultra endurance race and amazingly got accepted for the Transalba 2020, which happens next June. And we decided to start our training a little bit early in the October. About 10k into the ride, I took a bit of a hard crash on the pavement. The front end of the bike took the main brunt of it. Worst kind of thing of the whole story is I was bikeless. They've got a live chat on their app and on their website where you can immediately talk to someone and ask them a question. One of the members of staff there immediately, you know, responded to me and said, you know, can you give me a little bit more information? I sent them a picture of the front end of the bike and then basically just took it from there. Once I'd got the crash damage assessment from the local bike shop, they then had all the information where they could, you know, assess the claim. And literally within 24 hours, the amount of money that I had claimed for, which was against the frame, it was, yeah, 24 hours and the money was transferred into my account.
So if that sounds like the sort of insurance cover you would like for your bikes and equipment, go to LACA.co.uk to find out more. That's LACA.co.uk, spelled LAKA.co.uk.
I'm James Richardson, and if you want to kickstart your week with a lowdown on all the latest football news, analysis and miscellany, then why not join me for the Totally Football Show podcast every Monday morning? Our review of the weekend in the Premier League and beyond is available to stream and download as soon as you wake up. All you need to do is search for the Totally Football Show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and all the other usual places, click subscribe and never miss an episode. Find out more at thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Well, chaps, I don't know about you, but I've been watching the first couple of stages of San Juan, enjoying it because it's nice to see somewhere different and to see a lot of the familiar faces in unfamiliar landscapes. And there's a rawness and a sort of, I don't know, a kind of authenticity to the racing there that I quite enjoy watching. But something that's quite striking is Peter Sagan. One that he's not wearing, he's wearing team kit. I can't recall many occasions when he's been in standard team kit, his Bora Hansgrohe kit, albeit with the rainbow bands. But also he turned 30 a few days ago. And it's always quite a moment when a rider, especially a rider who we remember as this prodigy as a young man. In fact, the 2010 Tour Down Under, 10 years ago, was when he first came to our attention. But when riders like that turn 30, and Mark Cavendish was another one, it's quite a moment, isn't it, to take stock and to realise that a rider like that is probably, if not already in decline, will be starting that process quite soon. And so you start to wonder whether the results on his Palmares, the wins he's had, really do represent the talent that he has and the results that we thought he would have when he first emerged 10 years ago.
No, it's an interesting question, Rich, and particularly, you know, if you look at the types of race we expected him to sort of excel in and also really create a legacy in and leave his mark on the history of the sport would have been, I guess, the classics. And so far he's won two monuments. You know, I would say that's certainly below what we would have expected. But then on the other hand, he's won three rainbow jerseys, hasn't he? And, you know, plus 7 points jerseys in the Tour and... he has won 12 stages of the Tour de France. But I don't know, what about you, Napalm? Where do you think he's in relation to Parr?
Well, before I answer that one, just looking back to that Tour Down Under 10 years ago, Rich, the stage he came to prominence on was the one to Willunga, and he was in a break with Cadel Evans, which kind of gives you an impression of his, you know,
and
longevity.
Alejandro Valverde.
But
and Luis Leon Sanchez as well, actually.
Did he also not ride with the controversial Lance Armstrong that day, and he didn't have to pay a dime for it?
Well, that was at the curtain-raising criterium in Adelaide, 2 days before, he got in a breakaway with Lance Armstrong, and it was the youngest guy in the World Tour and the oldest guy in the World Tour, I think, at the time. So that's when he first came to prominence. And then a few days later, I've told this story many times, you're going to roll your eyes, Daniel, but he had a terrible crash because he was really getting involved in bunch sprints and things there, and he had a terrible crash, and I'd arranged to interview him that evening, and I assumed the interview would be off, but lo and behold, his DS was waiting in the lobby for me and took me up to his room, where he lay on his bed swathed in bandages and wanted to go ahead with the interview, even though he could barely speak English, and was more interested in watching the replay of the crash on television when the race came on and taking kind of great delight in it. I knew he'd go far.
Well, as you kind of, you mentioned the other riders that were in that first break. Cadel Evans, of course, long retired. Luis Leon Sanchez and Alejandro Valverde still racing. Sanchez is
still 36. Improving. Still getting better.
Valverde will be 40 in April. The other rider in that break was Luke Roberts, who's now a sports director at Sunweb. So that kind of gives you an idea. You know, Sagan was just a teenager, celebrated his 20th birthday that week. But to answer your question, Daniel, I kind of compare to Sean Kelly in a way, and I think when there are some parallels in that, you know, Sean Kelly probably should have won more Tour stages than he did. He should have won the Tour of Flanders, but the opportunity sort of slipped out of his back pocket once or twice. He did win, of course, Liège-Bastogne-Liège a couple of times. He did win the Vuelta. I can't see Peter Sagan winning even a Vuelta. You know, well, he's not going to win the Vuelta, is he? Breaking news. But I don't think Sagan's going to win a Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Although, you know, now with the course changed, you know, it's more likely than it was a couple of years ago. I think you have to look at the record of green jerseys, the rainbow jerseys, the two monuments he does have, and conclude that it's you know, he's probably on about par, isn't he? Do you not think?
I think that he illustrates this very strange point about cycling, that you can be too strong for your own good in a way. And, you know, Milan-San Remo, Flanders-Roubaix, these are all races that every year he can win. And every year he goes close in pretty much all of them. He's finished second twice in San Remo, fourth on three occasions. He's finished second once at Flanders. He's won it once. He's finished fourth. He's finished fifth. He's finished sixth. He's finished... he's not actually been as consistently good at Paris-Roubaix, and Daniel always said, of course, he would never win Paris-Roubaix, but he did. But he could have had a lot more of those three monuments in particular. The problem he's had many years, and this ties into another young rider who's also very, very strong, Matthew van der Poel, who will ride Paris-Roubaix this year, and was the subject of a provocative piece in Cyclist magazine suggesting that he would struggle to win a monument. And again, he's got the same problem. He's in a team where he's really the only card that they have to play. And countless times in races, in these races, that has proved Peter Sagan's undoing. It's been quite easy for other teams and other riders to beat him because he's been the only rider from that team that they've had to watch. Whereas, you know, when teams have had more than one card to play, they've had a better chance of coming away with a victory with one of those riders. So I think that's been his his biggest issue. His strength, his form has been there. He just hasn't been able to convert that into wins, other than on these two occasions at Flanders and Roubaix.
You make a really good point about the team, Rich, and you know his personality has been sort of so transcendent and so sort of dominant in the teams that he's been in, and I think also out of personal choice he's wanted to be the sole leader, but I think that has penalised him in terms of the monuments he hasn't won. The fact that he was at Liquigas and now Bora, often we felt that he has lacked support, and or the team has lacked a plan B, almost a decoy, and that's been the big strength of Quickstep over the past few years. It often hasn't been the guy you expected to win, but it's been his teammate. But having said that, I think you know the best years for a sort of classics hunter are probably, you know, 30 to 33. So I don't expect Sagan to retire with only two monuments in his palmarès. That said, if he did retire with the palmarès he currently has, you could argue that he's left a bigger mark on the sport with his personality than he has with his victories.
You could argue that. And just going back to that point very briefly, I did an event last week with Adam Blythe, who was a teammate of his at Tinkoff Saxo. And he was talking about the classics where they would go in with Sagan as leader, and it was almost as though he didn't really know how to use a team to his advantage in these races. And when they were coming up with the team sort of plan in the morning, he was asked, you know, once he came up with the plan, which was all about how does Sagan win this race, he was asking, what do you want from us as teammates? And he just kind of shrugged and said, just make sure you can see me. You know, it was there to be there in case of an emergency or a wheel change, something, rather than to use them in a strategic way. And I think, again, you need to have strong teammates to do that. But, you know, when he's had a Daniel Oss or somebody at his side, I think he's been a far more dangerous proposition than when he's been this, you know, sole leader. And I think that could be the problem that Vanderpool has this year in these races as well.
Yeah, just on his hall of monuments. I mean, you know, in order to win Milan-San Remo, for example, you would think he'd have to ride quite defensively and just hang in over the Poggio and wait for the sprint and use his Tour de France sprint, and that would give him the best opportunity. He's often been, you know, teased out into little groups or, you know, doing too much. Really, he's probably too flamboyant a rider to, you know, notch up the wins in a more sort of perfunctory manner. Just on Liège-Bastogne-Liège, I mean, he hasn't ridden it, of course. Last year there was the big talk, wasn't there, because the finish suits a rider of his characteristics much more with the sprint finish in the city. But he pulled out of the race, of course, didn't he?
And it might be even less like this year with him riding the Giro, because that would be a big block if he's going to go. He's going to ride Het Nieuwsblad this year as well.
I would also suggest the rider who won it, Jakob Fuglsang, and the way he won it sort of shone a bit of a light on how naive the idea was that Sagan could win on that course.
Yeah, I mean, those final couple of climbs are significant. And they were absolutely battered when they were coming over the top of it, as anyone who listened to the Lionel of the Ardennes would have heard last spring. And lastly, of course, you know, Sagan has not had the luxury that, say, Tom Bonan had in the sort of second half of his career. You know, once he basically said, I'm not doing the Tour de France anymore, Sagan is required to do the Grand Tours as well. And so he's not able to just kind of have a hot week or a hot fortnight in March, April.
He's not finished again. Of course, he's not finished. And ironically, I think his best chance of winning San Remo will come in the twilight of his career. Sean Kelly, Mario Cipollini. Did Kelly win it more than once?
He did. He won it and then won it again
He won it almost in his final year, and Cipollini had to wait a long time as well. And it might be for Sagan that it will genuinely be when he does just hang on over the Poggio and is there for the sprint, you know, and he's a powerful sprinter rather than a fast sprinter. So in the right circumstances, a San Remo could well be still within his grasp, I think.
But basically, just to sum up, the problem for Sagan is that for 20 plus riders in the final phases of all of those races, Milan-San Remo, Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, tactics 101 is watch Peter Sagan and kind of...
But that won't always be the case. I'm thinking about in two or three years, you know, that might play in his favour.
So when people start to underestimate him.
Exactly.
Again. Yeah, maybe.
Shall we wrap things up for this week, chaps? Any other business? Mitch Docker. We've got Mitch Docker coming out. We had Service Course last week with Lizzie Banks and Tom Wally. Really fascinating story in that about the development of the new British track bike. I learned a lot listening to that.
You said, Richard, that Service Course made you feel smarter listening to it.
It's all relative,
Lionel. You actually said it felt like your brain was bigger, and I wanted to know whether it wasn't the case that your skull was just getting smaller.
there could be something in that. I certainly felt new pathways opening up in my brain as I learned about the development of this bike and the kind of thinking behind it. So it's a really great listen.
And, you mentioned Mitch Docker. I'll just mention it again. We have signed up Mitch Docker's Life in the Peloton podcast series. It will be released on a fortnightly basis, kicking off with an interview Mitch did with Jimmy Whelan before Christmas. We've got some, I won't spoil who we've got coming up, but we've got some great ones in the pipeline as well. And if you want to know more about Mitch Docker, if you've not heard his podcast before, over the course of the week, we've run edited versions of some of the greatest hits from his Life in the Peloton series so far, featuring, among others, Mike Woods, Marcel Kittel, Theo Gegenhardt, and last
thoroughly
week's
enjoyable. I've really enjoyed listening to those.
Really, really entertaining listens. And last week's episode of our podcast, of course, was my trip to Girona to meet Mitch and put him on the other side of the mic. So if you haven't listened to that, do go back and listen to that.
And we're hoping to do a lot of other stuff with Mitch Docker this year as well. So stay tuned for that.
We'd better run that by Mitch first.
Oh, yeah. But I just said we're hoping to. So we also have our Friends system up and running for 2020. Of course, it's an improved system. Jonathan Rowe, the man behind that, sitting quietly in the corner here, just masterminding things and running things very smoothly. It works really well now, and you can get your Friends specials there. We've released, I think there are 4 episodes there already, and we're about to release the Tour de France Diaries for 2020. That'll be myself, Lionel, and Francois with our Grand Tour Diaries from the Tour de France last year. That will be out in the next week or so. Jonathan, you got something to say there? You can also sign up using Apple Pay now, so you don't even need your card details. You can also get it as a gift, can't you? So give the gift of friendship of the Cycling Podcast to somebody. And if you contribute a little bit more, if you think the Cycling Podcast is worth a little bit more of your hard-earned cash, then we'll send you a signed copy of our book, The Grand Tour Diaries, as well. Better get recording your Tour de France diary then, Lionel.
I had. I've got to do that this week, finish that off this week, because I'm off to Slovenia over the weekend and early part of next week.
You're ski jumping with Rog?
Not quite, no.
I mean, that would be a great French
youth special. Hosteling with Pogacar.
Well, what are you doing in Slovenia?
Well, you'll have to, friends of the podcast will find out very soon, Richard, what I'm doing there. I don't want to give too much away, just in case it doesn't all fall into place seamlessly. Bit of a surprise mission.
Great,
but it does mean I might not be here next week. You may have to find a workaround.
We've got a plan B actually, Daniel.
Have we?
I'll talk to you about that in a moment. I think it could be quite interesting, but we can manage
it
without you.
Sounds ominous.
Replace me with a bin liner of offal.
A tub of lard.
Oh.
Well, very much looking forward to listening to what comes of your Slovenia trip, Lionel. And, Daniel, looking forward to our alternative podcast next week. A real treat for the listeners, that will be. We'll resume the three of us in 2 weeks. In the meantime, thanks very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
And Lionel, I'm going to take you inside now and give you some leftover haggis, neeps and tatties from Burns Night.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Jonathan, there might be enough for you as well.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.